This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. Saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me, a voice was sounding. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting, and the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me.
Okay.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, and I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, the dust clouds rolling. Voice coming chanting, and the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. Broadcasting tonight from McDonald's in Titusville. It's been quite a day for me today. Took a ride up to Ormond Beach, where my grandmother used to live, and met up with, four of my cousins, I guess. And we went around the town, various different places, walked by my grandma's old house, and walked over to the cemetery where my grandfather and grandmother, D-Doc and Go-Go, went by their grave, and I took out a few of the ashes of my mom. This whole week has been quite a challenge for getting ready for a memorial service on Sunday. I think of it as a celebration of her life instead of a sad thing. Had people coming in from all over the country, and it warms my heart to have so much support from my family. I think families are very important. A lot of times in today's world, we don't think enough about family. But families help us to be who we are. You know, the Army talks about being who you can be. Nah, they're not the ones who do that. Your family is. That's who helps you be who you can be. On the New American Dream Radio Show, we dream of a better world and a better America, where people cooperate with each other, help each other through hard times, and have fun with each other through good times. We're always happy to lend a helping hand. So that's the way I want the world to be. That's the way that my mother, Marjorie Mott Gregory, taught me to address the world. And I miss her and I love her, but I'm sure proud to have her bringing all of us family together, and I'm glad I was able to get to a Wi-Fi spot and get this show out to you. And now I'd like to turn the show over to my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Chuck, tonight we welcome special guests Nicole Ferraro and Alan Mockey. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, New York City, War Road, Minnesota, and wherever you are. Please consider the White Rose and whether it has any relation to our current situation in 2013 in the United States of America. 70 years ago, on February 23, 1943, three courageous German college students at the University of Munich were beheaded by the Gestapo after being arrested 5 days earlier and convicted of treason earlier in the day. The group included 22-year-old medical student Christoph Probst, 24-year-old Hans Scholl, also a medical student, and Hans's 21-year-old sister Sophie. They were part of a small group of university students whose code name was the White Rose. As were many other alert Germans, the White Rose was fully aware of the atrocities that were being committed against certain non-Aryan minorities. They had seen clearly the loss of liberty, the shredding of human rights, and the disturbing reality that the war was probably already lost. By the summer of 1942, these savvy dissenters who knew that resisting Hitler in any form was a capital crime were fully aware of the existence of Nazi concentration camps and that hundreds of thousands of Jews had already been murdered in them.
I don't have time to.
These altruistic young Germans were also alarmed at the fear and apathy that they witnessed in the adults all around them. They were troubled by the fact that no active resistance movements were being organized by anyone that they knew. The White Rose students, of which were there were dozens scattered around Germany, knew that Hitler's aggressive war-making, torture, and state-sponsored terrorism were making Germany the most hated nation in the world. Being real patriots who loved their homeland enough to have an argument with it, they felt they had nothing to do. They had to do something to stop Hitler. So in late 1942, the White Rose started composing and distributing amazingly insightful, well-written leaflets warning their fellow Germans about the criminal regime that most Germans seemed to be tolerating without objection. These altruistic students were wise enough to realize that they needed to use nonviolent resistance tactics in their efforts. They had witnessed the brutality of the Homeland Security Agency, the secret police, and the See Something, Say Something policies that encourage folks to snitch on their neighbors. These students knew that the liberal printing presses had already been smashed by right-wing fascist thugs during the latter part of the made-to-fail 1920s Weimar Republic experiment in democracy, and that those thugs, mostly angry World War I veterans, had been aligned with militarized big business subsidized groups such as the Nazi Party. Even nonviolent resistance to tyranny was a capital crime in Nazi Germany. The major treasonous crime that the White Rose members were accused and convicted of was circulating a series of six subversive leaflets whose only purpose was to awaken fellow Germans to the atrocities that were being perpetrated by Hitler's henchmen and to try to motivate them to rise up in resistance. Of course, the major crime they may have been guilty of was embarrassing the Gestapo and humiliating the Nazis by successfully evading detection and capture for so many months. The Nazis thought that the influence of the White Rose ended with their arrest, trial, and beheadings. The trial, so well portrayed in the powerful movie Sophie Scholl, The Final Days, was orchestrated by the notorious Roland Freisler, the shrieking Nazi judge who had been ordered by Hitler to organize the infamous People's Court show trials that the Nazis then used for propaganda purposes and to instill fear in the people. Little did the Nazis realize that the executions of this heroic group, rather than eliminating them from the pages of history, actually made martyrs of them so that their spirits live on, continuing to inspire modern nonviolent resistance movements to this very day. excerpts from the third leaflet of the White Rose, February 1943. But our present state is the dictatorship of evil. Oh, we've known that for a long time. I hear you object, and it isn't necessary to bring that to our attention again. But I ask you, if you know that, why do you not bestir yourselves? Why do you allow these men who are in power to rob you step by step, openly and in secret, of one domain of your rights after another, until one day nothing at all will be left but a mechanized state system presided over by criminals and drunks? Is your spirit already so crushed by abuse that you forget it is your right, or rather your moral duty, to eliminate this system? Many, perhaps most, of the readers of these leaflets do not see clearly how they can practice an effective opposition. We have no great number of choices. The only one available is passive but active resistance. At all points, we must oppose fascism. Wherever it is open to attack, we must soon bring this monster of a state to an end. A victory of fascist Germany in this war would have immeasurable, frightful consequences. The defeat of the Nazis must unconditionally be the first order of business. Sabotage at armament plants and war industries, sabotage at all gatherings, rallies, public ceremonies, and organizations of the National Socialist Party. Obstruction of the smooth functioning of the war machine, a machine for war that goes on solely to shore up and perpetuate the Nazi Party and its dictatorship. Sabotage in all publications, all newspapers that are in the pay of the fascist government and the defendant's ideology. The press is run continuously to manufacture any desired amount of paper currency. Try to convince all your acquaintances, including those in the lower social classes, of the senselessness of continuing, of the hopelessness of this war, of our spiritual and economic enslavement at the hands of the National Socialists, of the destruction of all moral and religious values, and urge them to passive resistance. Aristotle said it is part of the nature of tyranny that everywhere the subject will be spied upon. And so it is part of these tyrannical measures to keep the subjects poor in order to pay the guards and soldiers, and so that they will be occupied with earning their livelihood and will have neither leisure nor opportunity to engage in conspiratorial acts. Please duplicate and distribute. And this was with the third leaflet of the White Rose, and these young people in Germany in the 1940s were beheaded for distributing these leaflets. And I just ask that we take a look at this, and if you couldn't hear me, you could go to the Duluth Reader online and read this. This essay on the White Rose was written by Gary G. Coles of Duluth and was published last week in the Duluth Reader.
I'd like to introduce our first guest, Nicole Ferraro. She's the editor-in-chief of UBM Future Cities. And Nicole, welcome to the show, and please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Thanks for having me. So as you said, I'm the editor-in-chief of Future Cities. I've been with UBM for about 6.5 years, and I started working on Future Cities in July to prepare the site for its launch, which happened officially on October 15th. So we spent the summer months getting the site ready in terms of content and in terms of contributors, and now we're rocking and rolling for about 4 months, and before that I was at UBM working on a publication called Internet Evolution for a few years, and before that I was at UBM working as a copy editor, which I started doing about 2 days after college. So it's been a fun career here so far.
Well, it's not everybody that gets to stick with one company for quite so long in today's economy. So
definitely not.
Good.
I've been very fortunate, and I've been very fortunate that they let me have a lot of fun here, too. Future Cities is a very serious topic, but, you know, we have a good time with the content as well.
Well, I read it regularly and enjoy it.
Thank you.
Recently, you were discussing the topic of cars in the city.
Yes.
And why don't you tell us what you said?
Yeah, sure. So maybe I should just really quickly just to explain the goal of Future Cities so that my car comments make some sense. It's an online community.
Absolutely,
for 20.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, Future Cities is an online community, business-to-business community for 21st century decision makers around the globe. So basically right now we have a tiny editorial staff of two people, but we have over 200 urbanization and city experts in different fields who are contributing blog and video blog content to the site, as well as several thousand registered users who are keeping the conversations flowing on the message boards, all in a goal to advance the conversation on cities of the future. So whether that's new cities being developed around the globe or existing cities that need to sort of change the way that they operate in order to be more sustainable and efficient. So to get to your question, you're asking me about something I wrote the other day, which I think I called Cars Suck, Why Driving in Cities Needs to Change or something like that. And I'm based here in Manhattan, and I was a car owner and a car driver when I was growing up. Well, not when I was growing up. I wasn't driving cars as a child, but I had a car when I was old enough to have one in Queens, where I grew up. And then once I moved to Manhattan, I got rid of my car, and it just, for me as a New Yorker, it makes so much more sense to not ever drive in the city. And I realized that New York City is fortunate in that it has a pretty efficient mass transit system, and we can do a lot of walking, and we're about to get a bike system, but a bike share program. But since this is a site about future cities, I thought it would be fun to have a conversation about getting rid of cars altogether, eventually, of course, keeping in mind that cars aren't going anywhere just yet. So it sparked quite a heated debate. I think that you got yourself involved in it. I'm not sure. If not, you at least were following along. And my point of view was essentially that we like to look at things from a pragmatic perspective on future cities. So there were a lot of people coming on the message board with really futuristic ideas for changing the nature of cars in cities to things like flying cars or mini single-seater pods and things like that. And I appreciate all input like that, but in my view, the reality right now is that we have to pay attention to basics. In other words, we can dream big for the future, but start small, because there are major hurdles to overcome when it comes to getting people around their respective cities if we're looking to eradicate cars, which just pollute the environment and make everything overcrowded and make it hard for pedestrians to get around. So for now, my point of view in the blog was that we should take practical steps. So things like more bike lanes, more bike share programs akin to what we see in Barcelona and Copenhagen and Washington, D.C., more pedestrian walkways, better investment in mass transit, and the creation of apps based on real-time data that can help citizens interact with mass transit more effectively. And overall, since cars aren't going anywhere just yet, more car share programs so we can both accept the reality that cars aren't going away, but also give people the option to share rather than own a vehicle. So even though I was being kind of, team, rather than saying get rid of your car totally, people still got a little bit heated about it, because people are very attached to their cars, particularly, I think, in America.
Well, I think that's true.
Yeah.
But the point that I made, yes, you're right, I did get involved in it. And
yeah.
The thing that I had pointed out was that if we were to take the amount of money we spend on cars, and I'm not talking about what private individuals spend on cars, but what cities spend supporting cars.
Yeah.
And spend that on public transportation, we'd have really slick ways of getting around.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. And we have a huge problem when it comes to investment in public transportation in this country. I mean, like I said, I come from New York, so it's not a huge complaint here, even though it is still hard for us to get money from Albany to improve our mass transit system. But it's a problem in cities, cities like San Francisco, which is so advanced in many ways. You don't want to take mass transit there, really. I mean, they're working on things like real-time apps and things like that, but their BART system is, everyone complains about it. And there's just, look at Los Angeles, that you're not taking mass transit around there. So it's just, if you were to take the money that we spend on roads and upkeep of highways and invest it in mass transit, or at least, bike lanes, and take some of the money away from the focus on cars and put it toward public transportation, we'd be in a much better place. But there's a very emotional argument that ends up happening when you start talking about taking funds away from from things that support automobiles, because people think that they're having their autonomy taken away and their individual freedoms. And that's just, you know, I mean, that's really a metaphor for, I think, a lot of the problems that we face. We've sort of morphed into this very selfish, individualistic society, and that's not really going to work in the cities of the future. So that's a big part of the conversation we're having on our site.
Well, I think there's very much a place for the individual, but not at the expense of society.
Right. I agree with you. I don't think, you know, we're all going to be living in some pod together, a big communal thing or anything like that. But I think that we're very individual focused and don't tend to look to the future. You know, there was a generation a long time ago that made all the investments in what we come to know today as ours, and that mentality of investing in the future seems to have gone by the wayside, and that's why we're seeing deteriorating infrastructure and no one's doing anything about it.
Okay. I think that's exactly right. It's funny you should mention the pods or whatever. The next thing I was thinking of asking you about was these micro apartments.
Yeah, well...
So why don't we sink into that?
Sure, that's fine. I mean, anyone who's... been reading Future Cities probably thinks I have a micro apartment obsession, because we've really been focusing on it quite a lot lately, but it's in part because it's recently become a big topic for New York City. For one reason is because the mayor, Michael Bloomberg, recently announced the winners of a contest he launched called Adapt NYC for architects and developers to come up with a design for the best micro unit, and that design was going to be chosen to be built in a city-owned building, I think, on 27th Street or something like that. And the reason this is such a big deal is because New York City isn't zoned to really legally allow micro units to be developed. However, just for anyone who's listening who doesn't know what a micro unit is, I guess it depends from city to city, but in New York it would be anything that's about 350 square feet or less. So in New York City, the zoning laws require any new development to be at least 400 square feet. However, we're expecting another million people in this city in the next decade, and we already don't have enough room for them. So the other reason that micro units came into focus for me is because this Museum of the City of New York did an exhibit called Making Room, in which it was examining different housing models that could support New Yorkers in the future and also work in other cities around the globe. So we went to the Museum of the City of New York and did a video with somebody named Sarah Watson, who is the director at the Citizens Public Housing Council, and she talked to us inside of a 325 square foot micro unit about the future of housing in New York. And the micro unit thing is really fascinating to me, in part because it's not legal and in New York, and also in part because it makes so much sense, because New York is now very much a place for not just young people, but people on their own. The demographics are changing all over the world. New York in particular has always sort of attracted the single creative type of person, and we're not zoned in a way to allow more of those people to come here and cultivate this city. So one thing that we're looking at is micro apartments. So it was great to go check it out in the museum and sit in it. But what's more going to be more interesting is to see in 2014 and beyond, when the development starts happening in East 27th Street, how this actually works in practice. Because in a museum, it looks great. You know, there's all this expensive convertible furniture created by some Italian furniture company, and it works fine as an exhibit, but it'll be interesting to see how it works in practice for New Yorkers who, I'm assuming, are going to have to supply their own furniture and are not going to be spending, you know, $7,000 on a convertible bed or something like that, especially if part of the building is supposed to be affordable housing. But I do think that the micro unit concept is interesting and more viable than ever in this digital age. We had a blog up on Future Cities Today by Alan Reiter, who writes about mobile technologies a lot, and he was basically pointing out that people can be digital nomads today. You know, you don't need all this stuff anymore. You can carry everything around in your pockets because, you know, everything's digital. And if people want to, and if they're willing to, they don't need to have so much space to live in because they don't need as much stuff. And the idea was for cities to start catering to that type of individual. So for me, part of the appeal of the micro units is that they're incredibly cool. You know, you can do a lot of things in a tiny amount of space if you, A, know what you're doing, and, B, are willing to take a look at all the stuff you've acquired and say what's really necessary here. So I would love for anyone listening to come check out the video documentary we did on the micro unit. I think we called it Making Room for Another Million or something.
People who live on boats have had to deal with this problem of very limited space.
Right.
All the time. I mean, there should be things available for them, you know, furniture, assorted, you know, tricky devices to, you know,
yep.
make use of the space.
Yeah, I think actually this is probably as great a time as ever for furniture companies to start thinking about how they can make their pieces convertible and affordable. Because if, you know, let's say New York City changes its zoning laws, that's going to be a space that blows up. I mean, I know San Francisco has zoning laws that allow units as small as, like, I think 150 square feet or something like that. So,
it's like a big closet.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty amazing. But I admire people who can live in such tiny quarters. But in cities where you feel like the whole city is your home and your backyard, it really, and the apartment is a stopover. Why not have a smaller space and you know, consume less energy and put out, you know, less of a carbon footprint? I think it's a great idea for cities of the future. Not to say it's for everyone, that's certainly not true, but you know, I think it's a great design idea.
Well, we've managed to use up our available time, but this has been really quite fascinating.
Great.
I'm glad you shared those two ideas and explained them to our audience. Thank you for appearing on the show. And in closing, can you please make sure that listeners know where to find you?
Oh, sure. Well, thank you so much for having me on. And you can find us at www.ubmfuturecities.com. And if you want to reach me, I'm at ferraro@ubmfuturecities.com. And I hope you'll come visit the site. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you, and have a good night.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Dateline, Vatican City. Headlines from the Vatican. Pope takes spring break in Cancun to help him cope. Won't take dope. Promise is not to mope. Will he be back? No, we hope. There's some word that he might be talking to the CIA about taking an undercover job investigating black market sales of delicious golden robes, big-ass rings, velvet shoes, and pointed hats. On Thursday, the Pontiff Benedict XVI greeted well-wishers from balcony in his window, spotted next to him with a hand on the Pope's shoulder, which what many observers thought to be the ghost of George Carlin. Claims supported by the retiring Pope's last words. When it comes to bullshit, you have to stand in awe of the all-time champion of false promises and exaggerated claims. Religion. No contest. Religion. Religion easily has the greatest bullshit story ever told. Think about it. Religion has totally convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do, every minute of every day. The invisible man is a specialist of 10 things he doesn't want you to do, and if you do any of those 10 things, you have a place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish. Where he'll send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of time. He loves you. He loves you and he needs money and he always needs money. He's all powerful, all perfect, all knowing, and all wise, but he somehow just can't handle money. Let's take in billions of dollars. They pay no taxes. They all, we need a little more. Now you talk about a convulsion story. Holy shit. Headlines. Vatican City. Headlines from the Vatican, sponsored by Pope, Soap on a Rope. And another news. Headline, Yakima, Washington. Six underground tanks that hold a brew of radioactive and toxic waste. The nation's most contaminated nuclear site. They're leaking. Federal state officials reported this on Friday. Now there's Bobby with March Madness Sports, Big Hamburger, Big Fancy Kitchen, and Numerology Report. Tonight's March Madness, Big Hamburger, Fancy New Kitchen, and Numerology Report is sponsored by the good folks at Teleprompter Corp. Hey. As we radiate the message, President Obama, we radiate the message to the American people. Well, Teleprompter Corp, of course. Osama bin Laden buried at sea. Sandy Hook. Drones fighting for freedom. Bail out the bankers. Ford going to get a $1.75 raise. Going to be able to eat at Wendy's now. Batman needs Joker. Like the U.S. needs Al-Qaeda. The word real would have to be invented. I know, right? Now, we're Teleprompter Corp. We bring the lies into your lives by putting the words into his mouth.
At the basketball game on Friday, everyone went outside the double glass doors to have a smoke at halftime. The weathermen, Stephen Sally Storm, Sandy Van Snore, big-time journalism whore, Buzz the Space Dog, War Priest, Father Jack Duffy, Carl and Buster, the last of the paper boys, were all out there enjoying the mild late winter night air. "We got to start running more zones," said Buzz. "How's the coffee?" asked Van Snore. "You ready for March Madness?" asked Father Jack. "Where are you guys going for spring break this year?" Carl asked the Storms. "Did you see that supposed phony medical examiner?" said Fred the Farmer as he held the door for Tina Thompson, Taco Bell trainee. "I know, right?" said Amelia Earhart, proprietor of Mount Liberty, Inc. tattoo shop, coming out the leather glass door. The talk quickly came around to Sandy Hook for a moment, with Fred and Amelia firing at each other back and forth. It was a total psyop. Nobody was killed. It was a drill. They were all actors. The same thing with Aurora in Tucson, 9/11. They're just learning how to use the TV so well. It's rather impressive to watch, actually. And then someone asked about the weather, whether it would rain or snow next week. "The Bahamas," Steve and Sally Storm said together, smiling, clicking their styrofoam coffee cups together. Troy, the town cop, pulled up in the cruiser on the curb, left it running, and walked up to ask Father Jack for a light. "Good snow," Troy said, and everyone looked up at the dark sky for a moment. They all flicked their butts into the grass or crushed them in the cement and then took their time heading back inside. Carl and Buster, the last of the paper boys, stayed out with Amelia Earhart of Mount Liberty, Inc. to have one more smoke. "Pretty good game," said Carl and Buster. "That one guy's a great shot." "Yeah," said Amelia Earhart, blowing the smoke straight up into the air, looking for the writing in the sky, not seeing it. She sent out her mental message, her psychic ... Morse code. "I am here, awaiting rescue. Abduct me." Those crazy CIA lone nut shooters, the Waco kids burned alive. 9/11, what really happened? Roundup at the OKC Murrah Corral, Operation Northwoods, Gulf of Tonkin, buried at sea, MLK, RFK, JFK. Muerte, Wellstone, killed by Cheney, Hit Squad. It's the new Hollywood lineup for the coming year, because you know what? We don't need the military or CIA to okay every film we make. We're actors, paid, big time, famous, celebrity, comfortable. No room, the old cutting room floor, you know. But you are going to dig the new Tom Hanks film. Lee Harvey Oswald did it alone. Already nominated for Best Picture, the Nobel Peace Prize, and Oprah's List. And get ready for Top Gun 4 this summer, Zero Dark 32, Rambo 9, and Red Dawn Again.
Troy, the town cop, was sitting in the Hardee's parking lot looking for speeders. He got a call to go check out some guys with assault rifles over by the elementary school. some guys in blaze orange and camo boots, plaid ear, flat cap, gloves, sitting in the soccer net. They say they're duck hunting. But hunting season isn't until we got every right. Yeah, I know. Second Amendment. Yeah, I know. But the elementary school? Why not out on the river? It's a principle, man. Don't you see? I gotta have your gun. Can't sit here. School property. Yeah, okay, we didn't think you'd be like this. Troy, thought we were in this together. Troy, the town cop, takes the guy's gun, waits in the squad until he sees him roar off in the blaze orange F-150, and now he's got all these guns in the back seat, and he can't go have coffee at McDonald's because now everyone's pissed at him. So what's he going to do? Got to live here for about 100 years yet, these guys. Well, Troy rolled down the window, smoked a cigarette, got out of the cruiser, opened the back door, and then drove off again, slow, speeding up and swerving every now and then, dropping a shotgun or an assault rifle into the street, one about every block. About a week, all the guns got back into the hands of their rightful owners, and Troy was back enjoying his coffee breaks at McDonald's, not outside in the parking lot, but right inside in the booth with all the guys. Troy looked down at his coffee cup that he was gripping tight with both hands, leaving indentations in the styrofoam. The only way they're getting this cup, he thought to himself, would be to rip it in my cold, dead fingers. He smiled and looked up to laugh at a joke he'd heard before.
Our second guest is Alan Mockey. Alan Mockey is a northern Minnesota activist, socialist, who has been involved in the peace, labor, civil rights, and environmental movements for over 30 years. We're waiting for Alan to call in. Let me see here.
Let's just move on. No American should live in poverty. Barack Obama. Well, it's about time. We'll do everything we can. We'll raise the minimum wage to $9 per hour. No American should live in poverty. Hey, how about all the poor people? Go sit and watch until that minimum wage gets jacked up to where people could actually live. That plan Martin Luther King had that, well, got him killed. That would be imprudent. Barack Obama, we need to live in the real world. Make sure to pick up a copy of the rerun, hit book and movie and reality show in your local Walmart. Hopeless, the Barack Obama story. And Alan is online now, Mike.
Alan Mockey is a northern Minnesota activist, socialist, who's been involved in the peace, labor, civil rights, and environmental movement over 30 years. Hello, Alan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Please take it away.
Okay. Tonight, I'd like to talk about a letter to the editor that I submitted to the Duluth News Tribune that was not published, and it's created quite a controversy. First, I'd like to read the letter and then the response I received back from the editor, Mr. Frederick, Chuck Frederick from the Duluth News Tribune. This is the letter that I submitted. Once again, with President Barack Obama's State of the Union speech, we got another politician hypocritically talking about jobs, jobs, jobs. If just one job was created every time some politician opened their mouth and started talking about jobs, 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 we wouldn't have any unemployment in this country, and everyone who wanted to work would have a decent living wage job. So, what is the main obstacle to full employment? Accountability from the very politicians who mouth the words jobs, jobs, jobs whenever they want to get elected, reelected, or thunderous applause, then go about their business forgetting about jobs as they go looking for their next bribe from a Wall Street lobbyist who views unemployment as the way to keep all wages down, which pushes profits up. What we need in this country is a real Full Employment Act, which mandates by legislation and law that the President and the United States Congress must maintain full employment as part of their responsibility to the American people. What good is a government that gets us into war after war but can't even assure full employment for the very people it taxes? Wars cause government debt and deficits. Peace and full employment eliminate debts and deficits. Signed, Alan L. Mackey. Then I waited for a length of time, and they didn't publish my letter, so I went ahead and submitted it to other newspapers. I had submitted the letter to the editor, to the Duluth News Tribune, on the basis that the letter was exclusive to the Duluth News Tribune. But when they didn't publish it or I didn't hear from them in a timely manner, I went ahead and submitted the letter to other publications. So I received this email from Mr. Chuck Frederick, who is the editorial page editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Mr. Mackey. The subject line of the email containing your letter to the editor's submission to the News Tribune indicated the letter was exclusively for publication in the News Tribune. Exclusively, as in only submitted to the News Tribune, but I'm finding your letter already published by the Bemidji paper and already published on at least two blogs. That's hardly exclusive. So, you were lying to us when you submitted your letter, or did you not understand what exclusive means? Chuck Frederick, editorial page editor, Duluth News Tribune. So, I called Mr. Frederick, and we had a discussion. In response to that discussion, I sent Mr. Frederick another letter, dated February 25th, 2013. Dear Editor Frederick, when I did not hear back from your newspaper in a timely manner, I decided to submit my letter to the editor to other newspapers. Your newspaper was the very first newspaper I submitted my letter to. I think I have the right to publish my own letter on my own blogs, do I not? With it still remaining an exclusive submission to your newspaper. Anyways, if the original ideas in my letter to the editor are not worthy of being published in your newspaper, that is up to you. The fact of the matter is, you repeatedly published the views expressed by all kinds of politicians as they hypocritically talk about jobs, 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 and not once have you, as the editorial page editor of the Duluth News Tribune, challenge these politicians by holding them accountable by asking where these jobs are. Nor have you ever suggested that since these politicians consider jobs, jobs, jobs to be the primary issue facing the country at election time, you don't follow up after the election asking them why they don't pass legislation making themselves responsible for full employment. If one newspaper does not respond as to whether they will publish my letter, I merely submit it to another for consideration. Obviously, I am aware my letter was on my blogs because I placed it there. I was also aware another newspaper, not the one you mentioned, published my letter after I submitted my letter to the Duluth News Tribune. What are you suggesting? I have a responsibility to notify you the letter is no longer an exclusive or else I become a liar? This seems rather petty of you. In my opinion, you have gone way over the line as the editor in calling one of your loyal readers a liar over this. Make no mistake, you are calling me a liar because I do know the meaning of exclusive. When was the last time you called Barack Obama or any politician a liar for saying they are for jobs, 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 when you know full well they aren't talking about creating jobs for every unemployed person who wants to work? What is it now? Something like 15 million unemployed people in this country and counting? When was the last time you called any of these politicians liars because they continue to talk day after day about debts and deficits, yet they continue funding these dirty wars for which they always manage to find the money, even though this adds to debts and deficits? In my opinion, I have not written about some kind of trivial issue, nor have I written about something that is anything other than a very major issue that the entire nation is focused on, jobs and unemployment. I have only written about an important issue, but I have suggested a solution to unemployment by making the President and the members of the House and Senate legislative responsible for attaining and maintaining full employment. If these politicians are going to campaign for our votes on the basis that jobs, jobs, jobs are their highest priority items on their agenda, then they should be held accountable once elected. Accountability can only be assured if full employment is made part of their job description and legislative duty. Feel free to call me any names you want. You obviously have the power to decide whether my letter to the editor is published or not in the Duluth News Tribune. In the interest of freedom of the press and the right of people to have access to all ideas and suggestions for solutions to pressing problems discussed in the proverbial public square, I am requesting you publish my letter to the editor in the Duluth News Tribune because it merits publication no matter how many times or where it has been published. You are certainly free to add your editorial comments about what you think of me or my ideas before or after the letter. That is what would best serve the public interest. Perhaps one of the politicians receiving this would like to respond to my letter. Perhaps some of your readers would like the opportunity to respond to my letter. Perhaps, since jobs, jobs, jobs is such a newsworthy issue, you could assign some reporters to go and talk to people in Duluth area to see what they think about my letter in relation to what the politicians have done to live up to their campaign promises of making jobs their number one priority when it comes to seeking votes but forgetting once elected. I have noticed on the editorial page of the Duluth News Tribune, you frequently endorse politicians who lie, and you endorse them more often than not on the basis of their lies, jobs, jobs, jobs being the perfect example, drone warfare being another. Use your power as an editor to do as you see fit with my letter to the editor. Not printing my letter won't hurt or bother me. It will be your readers who will be deprived of an alternative viewpoint. It will be your readers who will pay the price if not having access to one more idea. Let's see if there are any politicians who talk about jobs, jobs, jobs who might want to weigh in on this controversy of whether or not my letter to the editor should be published. The Duluth News Tribune has endorsed enough of them, all liars when they talk about jobs, jobs, jobs being at the top of their legislative agendas. All I ask is you not sue me nor turn me over to the authorities for punishment. As the last letter to the editor I wrote that was published in the Duluth News Tribune ended up in the FBI's Red Squad file they maintain on me. But there is another dirty little government secret. Just like the drone wars killing our jobs, just like they kill people, we shouldn't read about or talk about any of this. By the way, Mr. Frederick, have you ever considered there is a reason so many people turn to blogging in this country? I guess I can assume if I decide to run for the United States Senate, there won't be any use my stopping by the Duluth News Tribune's editorial offices seeking your endorsement if I should choose to run on a platform of jobs, jobs, jobs. Alan Mackey. And then Mr. Frederick called me back again after receiving this email. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. Submit another letter with the same ideas, but make it original and not the same as the first letter. So I submitted another letter to Mr. Frederick for consideration. And the next day I received another email from Mr. Frederick saying, hello, Mr. Mackey. Again, it was nice chatting with you yesterday. I have had the opportunity to speak with my colleagues here at the Duluth News Tribune and have come to the decision not to publish letters from you because of your intentional violation of our rule for exclusivity, among other concerns. All of our rules and requests related to letters to the editor and other submissions are published daily on the opinion page and are posted permanently at DuluthNewsTribune.com. Please know the decision was not an easy one. This is not an action we take lightly or often. My sincerest regrets, Chuck Frederick, editorial page editor. So, you see, this is all about democracy, and I hope people will consider what kind of news they're getting from the mainstream news media and what opinions are being included and what are being excluded. So until next month, you know, stick in there, struggle. We got to keep fighting for jobs, 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 and put these politicians on the spot and make them accountable. Thanks for listening. Alan Mackey, check out my blog, the Podunk blog.
Thank you, Alan. Have a good night.
You too.
Okay. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Occupy Dealey Plaza. That's where it all began. November 22nd, 1963, about 12:30 p.m. 50 years ago this year on November 22, 2013. Fill Dealey Plaza with protesters and signs and singing and speaking, and let them bring their dogs and their cops and their robbers and murderers and their sniper rifles and double secret video cameras and microphones. Occupy Dealey Plaza. We demand a truth commission to replace the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission. We want freedom. We want peace. We want real hope and real change. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let them know we know what they have done. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let the world know this is America. They say that America has more people in prisons than anybody, and that's good because it keeps us safe. The whole drug war thing that started in the 1980s and continues to today, where people are put away for dozens of years, and they build lots of new prisons, more than anybody really knows about. Don't worry about it. It's all good. Prisoner number 254-22329 teetered from the top bunk. The army blanket tickled his feet. He put his palms to the ceiling to keep from falling as the fire in the back of his head roared again. Number 254-22329 had been taken from his home just before dawn by the drug war first responders and driven in silence to this federal prison in the desert that could just as well have been on the moon. Was he on the moon? They absolutely refused to tell him. He looked down at the desk at the piece of the girl's color photo, the other half on the concrete floor. He leaned forward with his hands on the textured ceiling. He closed his eyes and locked his hands behind his back. His forehead would strike the yellow block wall on the third course. For 2 months, he had been locked in solitary on the administrative detention unit. After he tackled the caseworker who had refused to let him attend his daughter's 8th birthday party, each morning he got up, walked to the door to receive his breakfast tray through the slot. He ate sitting on his bed, lay down and smoked, handed the tray to the guard when he pounded. He slept if he could until lunch, then paced diagonally 3.5 steps each way for 3 hours. 30 times a minute, his wild eyes searched the vertical window for his children. He let the eyes look both ways, then he turned and did it again and again. He did 400 push-ups after his afternoon walk and would start sit-ups tomorrow, thousands. At 4, supper was served. He smoked, took off his slippers, and called it a day. His family can't or won't come to see him. Spanish and black talk echoed in his head, even for the few hours in the middle of the night when the unit was quiet. All they talked about was him. All day long, the machine gun screaming bounced around the steel like an endless 30-caliber ricochet. What was there to talk about all day and all night long? And the guards and the warden even talked about him, too. Even when they went home and sat at the supper table with their wives and children, they said, "You know what that guy did today?" And the children leaned forward and answered, "No, what now?" Light in his cell never went off. He's got a rash on the back of his hands, and they showed ghost white when he put them in front of his face. He could see through them. His eyes are an x-ray light. Last night a mouse ran across the floor. Number 254-22329 jumped to the floor and put his nose in the dust, growling, sliding along the floor, sniffing for the mouse, corner to corner. Once you back down from the first mouse, they all think they can push you around. He slept on the floor, and the mouse did not return. Well, it has been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. You might have seen that George H.W. Bush still lives, that old snake that we saw sneering in the back room on the night his son was dishonestly named President of the United States, the one who lied that he was out of the loop, the one who ordered the killing of thousands of people in Panama, the one who ordered the building of many new prisons to get tough on drugs and criminals in America. It was all a scam. All to get elected, gain power. George H.W. Bush, the one who sneered at the funeral of Gerald Ford when he mentioned from the podium the killing of John Kennedy. The one who claimed he was not in Dallas that day, but there is a photo showing he was. The one who sits in the front row at the baseball games on national television and is applauded, not hit with tomatoes and fists and handcuffs because he has been so successful in concealing the truth from the American people all these years, the one who has said that if the American people knew what he has done, they would string him up by a light bulb. good idea. And, well, there were some guys right here in Mount Liberty, some guys who suspected the truth about George H.W. Bush, who cared enough to find out the goddamn truth about our 41st president. They were not the leading citizens. They did not write the editorials or sign the loans or even cut the hair of those who did. They inhabited the underground, the earth, the destitute, the hated, the laughed at, the so-called criminals themselves, and they understood. They knew where the power resided, where the truth could be found, what the reasons were, where the bodies were buried. They could not understand, and they wanted to find someone to ask why there might be such a stink about even talking about the killing of a rich so-called leader, and yet the real-life slaughter of thousands, millions of poor people goes by without a whisper, a passing breeze in the trees that is gone and forgotten by the time the hail fellow well met in the cook's hat in the backyard shouts that the hot dogs are ready. So with nothing better to do, they decided to fight. AGB, they said, kill George Bush. Some apparently recent graffiti found in D Block. Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do? And they come for you, bad boys. More. Don Hinckley Jr., the attempted assassin of Ronald Reagan while George Bush Sr. was vice president. Well, his family is big friends with the Bush family. Something else in the D Block graffiti on the block wall. The family of Osama bin Laden is big friends with the Bush family and business partners. And another one. Anybody who thinks that Mark Chapman was just some crazy guy who killed my dad for his personal interests is insane, I think, or very naive. Sean Lennon. The men of D Block are Mark Pontiac, Bobby Ford, Stephen Baltimore, Martin Mumford, Billy Morningdove, Miguel Mendez, and Alfred Arthur. The new guy is Michael Zags, who is on his way to the jail, snatched from a downtown construction site for threatening the life of former President George H.W. Bush. The jailer is Don Burton. And Zags has got to come here. That's what Bobby Ford said. It all flows to here. Shit downhill, and that means right here, right here. Mark Pontiac fondled a single card. The keys rattled in the hall. Stephen and Martin sat on the floor in front of their cell, their arms splayed over their knees. Miguel Mendez perched on the steel toilet in his cell, his jumpsuit around his ankles, reading a Sports Illustrated laid flat on the shiny, smooth green cement floor. To a new person, the block smelled of years of cigarettes and shit and piss, but it did not bother the man there. The long-time prisoners smelled with their memories rather than their noses. Bill Morningdove crouched on the floor of his cell with his feet under his bed, using a flattened Marlboro carton on top of the mattress for a writing table. He sat on the limit of three New Testaments. At the table, Bobby Ford sat across from Pontiac, with his back to the cards, facing the television. He jumped up and grabbed the bars when he saw Burton leading a prisoner. "We get store today?" asked Ford. "Supposed to," answered the guard. He spoke into his walkie-talkie, and the outer Sallyport door opened with the sound of a pyramid fall. The prisoner walked in, and the outer door closed as the inner door clanged open. The prisoner walked in carrying a gray blanket, pale green sheets, toothpaste, toothbrush, and black comb, like a dead child in his arms. Each man studied the new man's arms and determined if he was weak or strong, a potential friend or enemy, whether he had cigarettes. The man sported thick black eyebrows and a mischievous half-grin like Abby Hoffman walking into a courtroom. He didn't appear to care about the stares. No one spoke to him, and he didn't attempt any pleasantries. He walked into the cell with a knocked-out Al on the lower bunk. He shinnied up and knelt on the thin mattress of the top berth like a sailor, joining the ship two stops down the line. He began to make his home, kneeling in the middle of the mattress, folding it back, tying the two ends of the sheet in a knot, then repeating at the bottom. The new guy fitted another sheet and pillowcase and smoothed out the scratchy blanket on top. He stretched out with his hands behind his head, his legs crossed at the ankles, the toothpaste, toothbrush, and comb fit nicely on the side between the mattress and the steel frame. Stephen and Martin walked past, staring in. The dark-haired man's orange suit was crisp, clean, new. He wore black socks inside his slip-on blue tennis shoes. Pontiac continued dealing. Morning Dove wrote, Bobby Ford walked up to the new man's cell door. He careful not to put a foot inside. Ford leaned on the bars. We saw you on TV, man. The man gazed at Bobby in silence. The feds bunking you here, then? Yeah. What's your name? Asked Ford. Zags, Michael. Zags, Michael, Ford said. Michael Zags, said the man. Same either way. AC Doocy, shouted Mumford. Oh, yeah, like Boy George, smiled Ford. The man sat up on the edge of his bed. He pulled an unopened pack of Marlboros from his jumpsuit pocket. He wore a white T-shirt underneath. Palindrome, said Pontiac, barely audible. Need a match, said Bobby. He reached up and handed Michael a pack with one match left. Get one of those, said Ford. We're supposed to get stored today. He looked into the hall. The two black men walked past slowly, staring up at the man on the top bunk. Michael Zags folded his pants leg up and flipped the ash in the cuff. How long you been here, he asked Ford. 9 months. I'm about due, huh? Going to trial pretty soon. I'll be getting out of here. I'm the new guy. He nodded his head. You been charged yet, said Bobby. No, I don't think so. The marshal said they'd be back, said Zags. Your celly had kind of a rough morning, Bobby nodded at Al, now beginning to rally. Al sat to the edge, his head bowed to fit under the top bunk. He rubbed his eye with the heel of an open hand, then noticed the feet dangling in front of his face. He jumped up and confronted Michael Zags. What? Oh, man, he said, what are you doing here? Shit. Buttoned his fly, unbuttoned his fly, and with eyes closed, took a leak in the stainless steel toilet with no lid. He leaned over, pushed the knob above the stainless steel sink, and leaned over to suck a drink from the faucet. He stood and wiped his mouth, looking up at Zags. When you get here? Just now, said Bobby Ford, stepping inside the cell. Am I talking to you? Said Al. The man can talk, can he? Just now, said Michael. He puffed a cigarette in his left hand and ashed in the cuff. Keys jingled. Burton appeared in the hallway, head down, arms pumping, walkie-talkie in his right hand, clipboard in the other. He stopped at the cell door. Child time! He hollered, then spoke into the machine. Men lined up at the door. Child time, Chief, you coming? Morning Dove stood in his door and combed his hair. He slowly buttoned his jumpsuit and flipped the comb back on the bed. The first door opened. The men crowded inside the sallyport. Morning Dove moseyed down, then inside with the rest. Burton spoke into his walkie-talkie, and the door closed as if he were speaking to the iron bars. The outer door opened, and the men elbowed their way into the hallway to begin fast walking, followed by a panting Burton speaking into his walkie-talkie. Yelling to front desk, he was taking D-block to the cafeteria. And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs. All the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security Gestapo COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average. And that is about, that's going to about do it. Chuck is having technical difficulties in Florida, and I'd just like to say thanks to Chuck for giving it the old college try tonight. He's had to broadcast from McDonald's in Titusville, somewhere near Fort Lauderdale, but finally he had to shut it down because I just couldn't keep it going. So good night to Chuck. Stay warm down there, and good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are. Good night, folks.